belief in his voice. "Let me ask you, Pendergast. Would you have fallen for that trap?"
"I suppose not."
"Well then, we underestimated the creature. We must stop thinking of it as a dumb animal. It has the intelligence of a human being. Did I understand correctly that the body they found in the exhibition was hidden? The beast knew it was being hunted. Obviously, it had learned to conceal its prey. Besides, I think we're dealing with more than simply hunger now. Chances are it's been temporarily sated by this evening's human diet, but it's also been wounded. If your analogy of the Cape Buffalo is correct, this creature may not only be hungry, but angry."
"So you think it's gone hunting?" Pendergast said quietly. Frock remained motionless. Then he gave a barely perceptible nod.
"So who's it hunting now?" Margot asked.
No one answered.
55. Cuthbert checked the door again. It was locked and rock solid. He flicked on the flashlight and shined it in the direction of Wright, slumped in his chair and looking morosely at the floor. Cuthbert switched off the flashlight. The room reeked of whiskey. There was no noise except for the rain splattering and drumming against the barred window.
"What are we going to do with Wright?" he asked in a low tone.
"Don't worry," Rickman replied, her voice tight and high. "We'll just tell the press he's sick and pack him off to the hospital, then schedule a press conference for tomorrow afternoon."
"I'm not talking about after we get out. I'm talking about now. If the beast comes up here."
"Please, Ian, don't talk like that. It scares me. I can't imagine the animal is going to do that. For all we know, it's been in the basement for years. Why would he come up here now?"
"I don't know," said Cuthbert. "That's what worries me."
He checked the Ruger once again, spun the cylinder, slid the safety on and off. 5 shots. He went over to Wright and shook the director's shoulder.
"Winston."
"Are you still here?"
Wright asked, looking up hazily.
"Winston, I want you to take Lavinia and go into the dinosaur hall. Come along."
Wright slapped Cuthbert's arm away.
"I'm fine just where I am. Maybe I'll take a nap."
"The devil with you, then," said Cuthbert.
He sat down in a chair opposite the door. There was a brief noise, a rattle at the door, as if the doorknob had been turned, then released. Cuthbert jumped up, gun in hand. He walked close to the door and listened.
"I hear something," he said quietly. "Get into the dinosaur hall, Lavinia."
"I'm afraid," she whispered. "Please don't make me go in there alone."
"Do as I say."
Rickman walked over to the far door and opened it. She hesitated.
"Go on."
"Ian,"
Rickman pleaded. Behind her, Cuthbert could see the huge dinosaur skeletons looming out of the darkness. The great black ribs and yawning rows of teeth were suddenly illuminated by a streak of livid lightning.
"Damn you, woman, get in there!"
Cuthbert turned back, listening. Something soft was rubbing against the door. He leaned forward, pressing his ear against the smooth wood. Maybe it was the wind. Suddenly he was slammed backward into the room by a tremendous force. Cuthbert could hear Rickman screaming within the dinosaur hall. Wright stood unsteadily.
"What was that?" he said.
His head ringing, Cuthbert picked the gun off the floor, scrambled to his feet, and ran to the far corner of the room.
"Get into the dinosaur hall!"
he shouted at Wright. Wright sagged heavily against the chair.
"What's that disgusting smell?" he asked.
There was another savage blow to the door, and the crack of splitting wood sounded like a rifle shot. Cuthbert's finger instinctively tightened on the trigger, and the gun fired unexpectedly, bringing down dust from the ceiling. He lowered the weapon momentarily, his hands shaking.
"Stupid one-wasted bullet. Bloody hell, he wished he knew more about handguns."
He raised it again and tried to take aim, but his hands were shaking uncontrollably now.
"Got to calm down," he thought. "Take a few deep breaths, aim for something vital. 4 shots.
The room gradually returned to silence. Wright was slumped against his chair as if frozen into place.
"Winston, you idiot!"
Cuthbert hissed. Get into the hall!
If you say so,
Wright said and shuffled toward the door. He seemed finally frightened enough to move. Then Cuthbert heard that soft sound again, and the wood groaned. The thing was pressing against the door. There was another horrible crack, and the door split wide open, a piece of wood spinning crazily end over end into the room. The table was thrown to one side. Something appeared in the gloom of the hallway, and a three-tined claw reached through the opening and gripped the broken wood. With a tearing noise, the remainder of the door was pulled back into the darkness, and Cuthbert saw a dark shape in the doorway. Wright lurched into the dinosaur hall, almost toppling Rickman, who had appeared in the doorway, choking and sobbing. "Shoot it, Ian! Oh, please, please, kill it!" she screamed. Cuthbert waited, sighting down the barrel. He held his breath.
4 shots.
The commander of the SWAT team moved along the roof, a cat-like shape against the dark indigo of the sky, while the spotter on the street below guided his progress. Coffee stood next to the spotter under a tarp. They both held rubberized waterproof radios.
"Dug out the red one. Move 5 more feet to the east,"
the spotter said into his radio, peering upward through his night vision passive telescope.
"You're almost there."
He was studying museum blueprints spread out on a table under a sheet of plexiglass. The SWAT team's route had been marked in red. The dark figure moved carefully across the slate roof, the lights of the Upper West Side twinkling around him. Below, the Hudson River, the flashing lights of the emergency vehicles on Museum Drive, the high-rise apartment buildings laid out along Riverside Drive like rows of glowing crystals.
"That's it," the spotter said. "You're there, Red One."
Coffee could see the commander kneel, working swiftly and silently to set the charges. His team waited 100 yards back, the medics directly behind them. On the street, a siren wailed.
"Set,"
said the commander. He stood up and walked carefully backward, unrolling a wire.
"Blow when ready," murmured Coffee.
Coffee watched as everyone on the roof lay down. There was a brief flash of light, and a second later the sharp slap of sound reached Coffee. The commander waited a moment and then eased forward.
"Red One to dugout. We've got an opening."
"Proceed," said Coffee.
The SWAT team dropped in through the hole in the roof, followed by the medics.
"We're inside,"
came the voice of the commander.
"We're in the 5th floor corridor, proceeding as advised."
Coffee waited impatiently. He looked at his watch, 9:15. They'd been stuck in there without power for the longest 90 minutes of his life. An unwelcome vision of the mayor, dead and gutted, kept plaguing him.
"We're at the cell 3 emergency door, 5th floor, section 14. Ready to set charges."
"Proceed," said Coffee.
"Setting charges."
Augusta and his group hadn't reported in for over 30 minutes. God, if something happened to the mayor, no one would care whose fault it really was. Coffee would be the one that caught the blame. That's the way things worked in this town. It had taken him so long to get where he was, and he'd been so careful, and now the bastards were just going to take it away from him. It was all Pendergast's fault if he hadn't started messing around on other people's turf.
"Charges set."
"Blow when ready," Coffee said again. Pendergast had fucked up, not him. He himself had only taken over yesterday. Maybe they wouldn't blame him after all, especially if Pendergast wasn't around. That son of a bitch could talk the hind legs off a mule.
There was a long silence. No sound of explosion reached Coffee's ears as he waited outside beneath the sodden tarp.
"Red One to dugout. We're clean," the commander said.
"Proceed. Get inside and kill the son of a bitch," said Coffee.
"As discussed, sir, our first priority is to evac the wounded,"
said the commander in a flat voice.
"I know, but hurry it up for God's sake."
He punched savagely at his transmit button. The commander stepped out of the stairwell, looking carefully around before motioning the teams to follow him. One by one, the dark figures emerged, gas masks pushed high on their foreheads,
fatigue uniforms blending into the shadows, their M16s and bullpups equipped with full-tang bayonets. In the rear, a short, stubby officer was carrying a 40-millimeter six-shot grenade launcher, a big-bellied weapon that looked like a pregnant Tommy gun.
"We've gained the fourth floor," the commander radioed the spotter. "Laying down an infrared beacon. Hall of Lesser Apes directly ahead."
The spotter spoke into his radio.
"Proceed south 70 feet into the hall, then west 20 feet to a door."
The commander took a small black box from his belt and pressed a button. A ruby laser shot out, pencil thin. He moved the beam around until he had the distance reading he needed. Then he moved forward and repeated the procedure, shining the laser toward the west wall.
"Red one to dugout, door in sight."
"Good, proceed."
The commander moved ahead to the door, motioning his men to follow.
"The door is locked. Setting charges."
The team quickly molded two small bars of plastique around the doorknob, then stepped back, unrolling more wire.
"Charges set."
There was a low whoomp as the door flew open.
"The trap door should be directly in front of you, in the center of the storage room,"
the spotter directed. By moving aside several flats of scenery, the commander and his men exposed the trapdoor. Undoing the latches, the commander grasped the iron ring and heaved upward. Stale air rushed up to greet them. The commander leaned forward. In the hall of the heavens below, everything was still.
"We've got an opening," he said into the radio. "Looks good."
"Okay,"
came Coffee's voice.
"Secure the hall. Send down the medics and evac the injured, fast."
"Red one, roger that, dugout."
The spotter took over.
"Tear out the drywall in the center of the north wall. Behind it you'll find an 8-inch I-beam to anchor your ropes to."
"Will do."
"Careful, it's a 60-foot drop."
The commander and his team worked swiftly, punching through the drywall, looping two chains around the I-beam, attaching locking carabiners, a block and tackle. A team member hooked a rope ladder to one of the chains and dropped it through the hole. The commander leaned over once again, shining his powerful light down into the gloom of the hall.
"This is Red One. We've got some bodies down here," he said.
"Any sign of the creature?"
Coffee asked.
"Negative. Looks like 10, 12 bodies, maybe more. Ladder's in place now."
"What are you waiting for?"
The commander turned to the medic team.
"We'll signal when we're ready. Start lowering the collapsible stretchers. We'll take them out one by one."
He grabbed the rope ladder and started down, swinging over the vast empty space. The men followed one by one. Two fanned out to provide suppressing fire as necessary, while two others set up tripods with clusters of halogen lamps, hooking them to the portable generators being lowered by ropes. Soon the center of the hall was flooded with light.
"Secure all ingress and egress," shouted the commander. "Medic team, descend."
"Report,"
Coffee cried over the radio.
"We've secured the hall," the commander said. "No sign of any animal. Medic team deploying now."
"Good. You'll need to find the thing, kill it, and locate the mayor's party. We believe they went down the stairwell back by the service area."
"Roger, dugout," said the commander.
As the commander's radio buzzed into silence, he heard a sudden report, muffled but unmistakable.
"Red one to dugout. We just heard a pistol shot. Sounded like it was coming from above."
"Damn it, go after it. Take your men and go after it."
The commander turned to his men.
"All right. Red two, red three, finish up and secure here. Take the grenade launcher. The rest of you, come with me."
56. The viscous water was now lapping at Smithback's waist. Just keeping his balance was exhausting. His legs had long since gone numb and he was shivering.
"This water is rising awful damn fast,"
DeGusta said.
"I don't think we need to worry about the creature anymore,"
Smithback said hopefully.
"Maybe not. You know, you were pretty quick back there jamming the door with a flashlight like that. I guess you saved all our lives."
"Thanks,"
said Smithback, liking DeGusta more and more.
"Don't let it go to your head,"
DeGusta said over the rush of the water.
"Everyone okay?"
DeGusta turned back to the mayor.
The mayor looked haggard.
It's touch and go. There are a few who are slipping into shock or exhaustion, maybe both. Which way from here?
His eyes searched them. DeGusta hesitated.
I really can't say anything conclusively. Smithback and I'll try the right fork first.
The mayor looked back at the group, then moved closer to DeGusta.
Look, I know you're lost. You know you're lost. But if those people back there learn about it, I don't think we'd get them to go any farther. It's very cold standing here, and the water is getting higher. So why don't we all try it together? It's our only chance. Even if we wanted to retrace our steps, half these people would never make it against the current.
DeGusta looked at the mayor for a moment.
All right,
he said at last. Then he turned to the group.
Listen up now. We're going to be taking the right tunnel. Everyone join hands, form a line. Hold on tight. Stay against the wall. The current's getting too strong in the center. If anyone slips, give a yell, but don't let go under any circumstances. Everybody got that? Let's go.
The dark shape moved slowly through the broken door, stepping cat-like over the splintered wood. Cuthbert felt pins and needles in his legs. He wanted to shoot, but his hands refused to obey.
Please, go away,
he said so calmly he surprised himself. It stopped suddenly and looked directly at him. Cuthbert could see nothing in the dim light but the huge, powerful silhouette and the small red eyes. They looked somehow intelligent.
Don't hurt me,
Cuthbert pleaded. The creature remained still.
I've got a gun,
Cuthbert whispered. He aimed carefully.
I won't shoot if you go away,
he said quietly. It moved slowly sideways, keeping its head turned toward Cuthbert. Then there was a sudden movement, and it was gone. Cuthbert backed away in a panic, his flashlight skittering wildly across the floor. He spun around frantically. All was silent. The creature's stench filled the room. Suddenly he found himself stumbling into the dinosaur hall, and then he was slamming the door behind him.
The key! He cried. Lavinia, for God's sake!
He looked wildly around the darkened hall. Before him, a great Tyrannosaurus skeleton reared up from the center. In front of it squatted the dark form of a Triceratops, its head lowered, the great black horns gleaming in the dull light. He heard a sobbing, then he felt a key being pressed into his palm. He swiftly locked the door.
Let's go,
he said, guiding her away from the door, past the clawed foot of the Tyrannosaur. They moved deeper into darkness. Suddenly, Cuthbert pulled the public relations director to one side, then guided her into a crouch. He peered into the gloom, senses straining. The hall of Cretaceous dinosaurs was deathly silent. Not even the sound of the rain penetrated this dark sanctum. The only light came from rows of high clerestory windows. Surrounding them was a herd of small Struthiomimus skeletons, arranged in a defensive formation before the monstrous skeleton of a carnivorous Dryptosaurus, its head down, jaws open, and huge claws extended. Cuthbert had always relished the scale and drama of this room, but now it frightened him. Now he knew what it was like to be hunted. Behind them, the entrance to the hall was blocked by a heavy steel emergency door.
"Where's Winston?"
Cuthbert whispered, peering through the bones of the Dryptosaur.
"I don't know," Rickman moaned, gripping his arm. "Did you kill it?"
"I missed," he whispered. "Please let me go. I need to have a clear shot."
Rickman released him, then crawled backward between two of the Struthiomimus skeletons, curling herself into a fetal position with a stifled sob.
"Be silent,"
Cuthbert hissed. The hall lapsed again into a profound stillness. He looked around, probing the shadows with his eyes. He hoped Wright had found refuge in one of the many dark corners.
"Ian?"
came a subdued voice.
"Lavinia?"
Cuthbert turned and saw to his horror that Wright was leaning against the tail of a Stegosaurus. As he watched, Wright swayed, then recovered.
"Winston!"
Cuthbert hissed.
"Get under cover!"
but Wright began walking unsteadily toward them.
"Is that you, Ian?"
Wright said, his voice puzzled. He stopped and leaned for a moment against the corner of a display case.
"I feel sick," he said matter-of-factly.
Suddenly, an explosive noise rocketed across the hall, echoing crazily in the enormous space. Another crash followed. Dimly, Cuthbert saw that Wright's office door was now a jagged hole. A dark form emerged. Behind him, Rickman screamed and covered her head. Through the skeleton of the Dryptosaurus, Cuthbert could see the dark shape moving swiftly across the open floor. Straight for him, he thought, but it suddenly veered toward the shadowy figure of Wright. The two shadows merged. Then Cuthbert heard a wet crunching noise, a scream, and silence. Cuthbert raised the gun and tried to sight through the ribs of the mounted skeleton. The silhouette rose up with something in its mouth, shook its head slightly, and made a sucking noise. Cuthbert closed his eyes, squeezing the trigger. The Ruger bucked in his hand, and he heard a blast and a loud clattering. Now Cuthbert saw that the Dryptosaurus was missing part of a rib. Behind him, Rickman gasped and moaned. The dark shape of the creature beyond was gone. A few moments went by, and Cuthbert felt the hinges of his sanity begin to loosen. Then, in a flicker of lightning through the clerestory, Cuthbert clearly saw the beast moving swiftly along the near wall, coming directly toward him, its red eyes fixed on his face. He swung the barrel and began firing wildly, three quick shots, each white flash illuminating rack upon rack of dark skulls, teeth, and claws. The real beast suddenly lost in this wilderness of savage, extinct creatures, and then the gun was clicking as the hammer fell harmlessly on the expended chambers. As if from a half-remembered dream, Cuthbert heard the distant sound of human voices coming from the direction of Wright's old lab, and suddenly he was running, heedless of obstacles, through the ruined door, through Wright's lab, and into the dark corridor beyond. He heard himself screaming, and then a spotlight was shining in his face, and somebody grabbed him and pinned him against a wall. "Calm down. You're all right. Look, there's blood on him." "Get the gun away from him," someone else said. "Is he the one we're after?" "No, they said an animal, but don't take any chances." "Stop struggling." Another scream rose in Cuthbert's throat.
"It's back there," he cried. "It'll kill you all. It knows. You can see in its eyes that it knows."
"Knows what?" "Don't bother talking to him. He's raving."
Cuthbert suddenly went limp. The commander came forward.
"Is anyone else back there?" he asked, shaking Cuthbert's shoulder.
"Yes,"
Cuthbert finally said.
"Right. Rickman."
The commander looked up.
"You mean Winston Wright, the director of the museum? You must be Dr. Cuthbert, then. Where is Wright?"
"It was eating him," said Cuthbert.
"Eating the brains. Just eating and eating. It's in the dinosaur hall, through the lab there."
"Take him back to the hall and have the medics evacuate him," said the commander to two members of his team. "You three, let's go, on the double."
He raised his radio.
"Red One to dugout. We've located Cuthbert, and we're sending him out."
"They're in this laboratory here," said the spotter, pointing at the blueprints. Now that the penetration was complete and the team was deep inside the museum, the two had moved inside the mobile command unit, away from the hammering rain.
"The lab's clear,"
the commander's monotone came over the radio.
"Proceeding into the dinosaur hall. This other door has been broken down, too."
"Go in and take that thing out,"
cried Coffey.
"But watch out for Dr. Wright, and keep a clear frequency. I want to be in touch at all times."
Coffey waited, tensed over the set, hearing the faint hiss and crackle of the static over the open frequency. He heard the clink of a weapon and a few whispers.
"Smell that?"
Coffey leaned closer. They were almost there. He gripped the edge of the table.
"Yep,"
a voice answered. There was rattling.
"Kill the light and stay in the shadows. Red 7, cover the left side of that skeleton. Red 3, go right. Red 4, get your back to the wall. Cover the far sector."
There was a long silence. Coffey could hear heavy breathing and faint footfalls. He heard a sudden explosive whisper.
"Red 5, look, there's a body here."
Coffey felt his stomach tighten.
"No head. Nice. Here's another one." See it? Lying in that group of dinosaurs.
More clinking and rattling of weapons, more breathing.
Red Seven, cover our path of retreat. There's no other way out. It may still be here. That's far enough, Red Five.
Coffee's knuckles whitened. Why the fuck didn't they get it over with? These guys were a bunch of old women. More rattling of metal.
Something's moving! Over there!
The voice was so loud, Coffee jumped, and then a burst of automatic weapons fire dissolved immediately into static as the frequency overloaded. Shit! 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 Coffee began saying over and over. Then for an instant he could hear screaming, and then more static. The even cadence of machine gun fire. Then silence. The tinkling sound of something, what? Shattered dinosaur bones dropping and rolling on the marble floor? Coffee felt a flood of relief. Whatever it was dead. Nothing could have survived the shitload of firepower just unloaded. The nightmare was finally over. He eased himself down in a chair.
Red Five, Hoskins, oh shit!
The voice of the commander screamed over the frequency. The voice was suddenly buried by the staccato of gunfire, then more static. Or was it a scream? Coffee surged to his feet and turned to an agent standing behind him. He opened his mouth to speak, but no sound came out. He read his own terror in the agent's eyes.
Red One! He yelled into the mic. Red One, do you read?
All he could hear was static.
Talk to me, Commander, do you read? Anyone?
He switched frequencies wildly to the team in the Hall of the Heavens.
Sir, we're removing the last of the bodies now,
came the voice of a medic.
The rear detail of the SWAT team just evacuated Dr. Cuthbert to the roof. We just heard firing from upstairs. Are we going to need more evacuation?
Get the hell out!
Coffee screamed.
Get your asses out! Get the fuck out and pull up the ladder!
Sir, what about the rest of the SWAT team? We can't leave those men...
They're dead, understand? That's an order!
He dropped the radio and leaned back, gazing vaguely out the window. A morgue truck slowly moved up toward the massive bulk of the museum. Someone tapped him on the shoulder. Sir, Agent Pendergast is requesting to speak with you. Coffee slowly shook his head.
No, I don't want to talk to that fuck, you got that?
Sir, he don't mention his name to me again.
Another agent opened the rear door and came inside, his suit sodden.
Sir, the dead are coming out now.
Oh, who are you talking about?
The people from the Hall of the Heavens. There were 17 dead, no survivors.
Cuthbert, the guy you took out of the lab, is he out?
They've just lowered him to the street.
I want to talk to him.
Coffee stepped outside and ran down past the ambulance circle, his mind numb. How could a SWAT team buy it just like that? Outside, two medics with a stretcher approached.
Are you Cuthbert?
Coffee asked the still form. The man looked around with unfocused eyes. The doctor pushed past Coffee, sliced open Cuthbert's shirt, then inspected his face and eyes.
There's blood here, he said. Are you hurt?
I don't know, said Cuthbert.
Blood pressure high normal, temperature 99 plus. I'll have an EKG in 60, said a paramedic.
You're okay?
The doctor asked.
Is this your blood?
I don't know.
The doctor looked swiftly down Cuthbert's legs, felt them, felt his groin, examined his neck.
EKG within normal limits, said the paramedic.
The doctor turned toward him.
He's stable. Put him in an ambulance and take him for observation.
The medics wheeled the stretcher away.
Cuthbert, said Coffee, jogging beside him. Did you see it?
See it?
Cuthbert repeated.
See the fucking creature.
It knows,
Cuthbert said.
Knows what?
It knows what's going on. It knows exactly what's happening.
What the hell does that mean?
It hates us, said Cuthbert.
As the medics threw open the door of an ambulance, Coffee yelled,
What did it look like?
There was sadness in its eyes, said Cuthbert. Infinite sadness.
He's a lunatic, said Coffee to no one in particular.
You won't kill it, he added with calm certainty.
The door slammed shut.
The hell I won't,
shouted Coffee at the retreating ambulance.
Fuck you, Cuthbert. The hell I won't.
57. Pendergast lowered the radio and looked at Margot.
The creature just killed the better part of the SWAT team. Dr. Wright, too, from the sound of it. Coffee withdrew everyone else, and he won't answer my summons. He seems to think everything is my fault.
He's got to listen. We know what to do now. All they need to do is come in here with Klieg lights.
I understand what's happening. He's overloaded, looking for scapegoats. We can't rely on his help.
My God. Dr. Wright.
Margot put a hand to her mouth.
If my plan had worked, if I'd thought everything through, maybe all those people would still be alive.
And perhaps Lieutenant DeGusta and the mayor and all those others below us would be dead,
Pendergast said. He looked down the hallway.
I suppose my duty now is to see you two out safely. Perhaps we should take the route I suggested to DeGusta, assuming those blueprints didn't lead him astray, of course.
Then he glanced at Frock.
No, I don't suppose that would work.
Go ahead. Don't stay here on my account.
Pendergast smiled thinly.
It isn't that, Doctor. It's the inclement weather. You know how the sub-basement floods during rainy spells. I heard someone on the police radio saying the rain outside has been approaching monsoon strength for the last hour. When I was sprinkling those fibers into the sub-basement, I noticed the water was at least 2 feet deep and flowing quickly eastward. That would imply drainage from the river. We couldn't get down there now even if we wanted to.
Pendergast raised his eyebrows.
If DeGusta isn't out by now, well, his chances are marginal at best.
He turned toward Margot.
Perhaps the best thing would be for you two to stay here, inside the secure area. We know the creature can't get past this reinforced door. Within a couple of hours, they're sure to restore power. I believe there are several men still trapped in security command in the computer room. They may be vulnerable. You've taught me a lot about this creature. We know its weaknesses, and we know its strengths. Those areas are near a long, unobstructed hallway. With you two safe in here, I can hunt it for a change.
No, you can't do it by yourself.
Perhaps not, Miss Green, but I plan on making a fairly good imitation of it.
I'm coming with you.
Sorry.
Pendergast stood by the open door to the secure area expectantly.
That thing is highly intelligent. I don't think you can go up against it alone. If you think that because I'm a woman...
Pendergast looked astonished.
Miss Green, I'm shocked you would have such a low opinion of me. The fact is, you've never been in this kind of situation before. Without a gun, you can't do anything.
Margot looked at him combatively.
I saved your ass back there when I told you to switch on your lamp,
she challenged. He raised an eyebrow. From the darkness, Frock said,
Pendergast, don't be a southern gentleman fool. Take her.
Pendergast turned to Frock.
Are you sure you'll be all right on your own, Doctor? We'll need to take both the flashlight and the miner's lamp if we're to have any chance of success.
Of course,
Frock said with a dismissive wave.
I could use a bit of rest after all this excitement.
Pendergast hesitated a moment longer, then looked bemused.
Very well. Margot, lock the doctor inside the secure area, get his keys and what's left of my suit jacket, and let's go.
Smithback gave the flashlight a savage shake. The light flickered, grew brighter for a moment, then dimmed again. DeGusta said,
If that light goes out, we're fucked. Turn it off. We'll switch it on now and then to check our progress.
They moved through the darkness, the sound of rushing water filling the close air. Smithback led, Behind him came DeGusta, grasping the journalist's hand, which, like the rest of him, had grown almost entirely numb. Suddenly, Smithback pricked up his ears. In the dark, he gradually became aware of a new sound.
"You hear that?"
Smithback asked.
DeGusta listened.
"I hear something."
"It sounds to me like
a waterfall.
But whatever it is must be a ways off. Sounds carry in this tunnel. Keep it to yourself."
The group slogged on in silence.
"Light,"
said DeGusta. Smithback turned it on, played it down the empty hall in front of them, then switched it off again. The sound was louder now, quite a bit louder, in fact. He felt a surge in the water.
"Shit,"
said DeGusta. There was a sudden commotion behind them.
"Help! I've slipped! Don't let go!"
"Grab her, somebody!"
the mayor shouted. Smithback snapped on the light and angled it quickly backward. A middle-aged woman was thrashing about in the water, her long evening dress billowing out across the inky water. The mayor shouted,
"Stand up! Anchor your feet!"
"Help me!"
she screamed. Smithback shoved the flashlight into his pocket and braced himself against the current. The woman was floating directly toward him. He saw her arm lash out and felt it wrap around his thigh in a vice-like grip. He felt himself slipping.
"Wait! Stop struggling! I've got you!"
Her legs kicked out and wrapped around his knees. Smithback lost his grip on DeGusta and staggered forward, marveling at her strength even as he was pulled off balance.
"You're dragging me under,"
he said, toppling to his chest in the water and feeling the current sucking him downward. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw DeGusta wading in his direction. The woman clambered onto him in a blind panic, forcing his head underwater. He rose up under her damp gown, and then it was clinging to his nose and chin, disorienting him, suffocating him. A great lassitude began to sweep over him. He went under a second time, a strange, hollow roaring in his ears. Suddenly, he was above the water again, choking and coughing. A dreadful shrieking was coming from the tunnel ahead of them. He was held in a powerful grip.
DeGusta's grip. "We lost the woman. Come on."
Her shrieks echoed toward them, growing fainter as she was swept farther downstream. Some of the guests were shouting and crying directions to her, others sobbing uncontrollably.
"Quick, everybody! Stay against the wall! Let's move forward, and whatever you do, don't break the chain!"
Under his breath, he muttered to Smithback,
"Tell me you've still got the flashlight."
"Here it is,"
Smithback said, testing it.
"We have to keep going or we'll lose everybody,"
DeGusta muttered. Then he laughed a short, mirthless laugh.
"Looks like I saved your life this time. That makes us even, Smithback."
Smithback said nothing. He was trying to shut out the horrifying, anguished screams, fainter now and distorted by the tunnel. The sound of roaring water grew clearer and more menacing. The event had demoralized the group.
"We'll be all right if we just hold hands,"
Smithback heard the mayor shout.
"Keep the chain intact."
Smithback gripped DeGusta's hand as hard as he could. They waded downstream in the darkness.
"Light,"
said DeGusta. Smithback switched on the beam, and the bottom dropped out of his world. 100 yards ahead, the high ceiling of the tunnel sloped downwards to a narrow semicircular funnel. Beneath it, the roiling water writhed and surged thunderously, then plunged abruptly into a dark chasm. Heavy mist rose, bearding the mossy throat of the pit with dark spray. Smithback watched, slack-jawed, as all his hopes for a bestseller, all his dreams, even his wish to stay alive, disappeared into the whirlpool. Dimly, he realized that the screaming behind him wasn't screaming, but cheering. He looked back and saw the bedraggled group staring upward above his head. At the point where the curved brickwork of the ceiling met the wall of the tunnel, a dark hole yawned, perhaps 3 feet square. Poking out of it was the end of a rusty iron ladder bolted to the ancient masonry. The cheering rapidly died away as the awful truth dawned.
"It's too fucking far to reach,"
58. They moved away from the secure area and stealthily climbed a stairwell. Pendergast turned to Margot, put a finger to his lips, then pointed to the crimson splashes of blood on the floor. She nodded. The beast had gone this way when it ran from their lights. She remembered that she'd been up this staircase just the day before with Smithback, evading the guard. She followed Pendergast as he flicked off the miner's lamp, cautiously opened the first-floor door, and moved out into the darkness beyond, the bundle of fibers clasped over his shoulder. The agent stopped a moment, inhaling.
"I don't smell anything," he whispered. "Which way to security command in the computer room?"
"I think we go left from here," Margot said, "and then through the Hall of Early Mammals. It's not too far away. Just around the corner from security command is the long hallway Dr. Frock told you about."
Pendergast switched on the flashlight briefly and shone it down the corridor.
"No blood spore," he murmured. "The creature headed straight upstairs from the secure area, past this landing, and right toward Dr. Wright, I'm afraid."
He turned toward Margot.
"And how do you propose we lure it here?"
"Use the fibers again," she replied.
"It didn't fall for that trick last time."
"But this time we're not trying to trap it. All we want to do is lure it around the corner. You'll be at the other end of the hallway, ready to shoot. We'll just leave some fibers at one end of the hall. We'll make at the far end.
A blind."
"Right, a blind. And we'll be hiding there in the dark. When it comes, I'll train the miner's light onto it, and you can start shooting."
"Indeed. And how'll we know when the creature has arrived? If the hallway is as long as Dr. Frock says it is, we may not be able to smell it in time."
Margot was quiet.
"That's tough," she finally admitted. They stood for a moment in silence. "There's a glass case at the end of the hall," Margot said. "It's meant to display new books written by museum staff, but Mrs. Rickman never bothered to have it filled, so it won't be locked. We can put the bundle in there. The creature may be out for blood, but I doubt it'll be able to resist that. It'll make some noise prying open the case. When you hear the noise, you shoot."
"Sorry," Pendergast said after a moment, "but I think it's too obvious. We have to ask the question again. If I came across a setup like this, would I know it was a trap? In this case, the answer is yes. We need to think of something a little more subtle. Any new trap that uses the fibers as bait is bound to arouse its suspicions."
Margot leaned against the cold marble wall of the corridor.
"It has an acute sense of hearing as well as smell," she said.
"Yes?"
"Perhaps the simplest approach is best. We use ourselves as bait. We make some noise, talk loudly, sound like easy prey."
Pendergast nodded.
"Like the ptarmigan, feigning a broken wing, drawing off the fox. And how'll we know it's there?"
"We'll use the flashlight intermittently. Wave it about, shine it down the hall. We'll use the low setting. It may irritate the creature, but it won't rebuff it. But it will allow us to see it. The creature will think we're looking around, trying to find our way. Then when it comes for us, I switch to the miner's light and you start shooting."
Pendergast thought for a moment.
"What about the possibility of the creature coming from the other direction, from behind us?"
"The hall dead ends in the staff entrance to the Hall of Pacific Peoples," Margot pointed out.
"So we'll be trapped at the end of a cul-de-sac," Pendergast protested. "I don't like it."
"Even if we weren't trapped," Margot said, "we wouldn't be able to escape if you miss your shots. According to the extrapolator, the thing can move almost as fast as a greyhound."
Pendergast thought for a moment.
"You know, Margot, this plan might work. It's deceptively simple and uncluttered, like a Zurbaran still life or a Bruckner's symphony. If this creature devastated a SWAT team, it probably feels there isn't much more that human beings can do to it. It wouldn't be as cautious.
And it's wounded, which may slow it down."
"Yes, it's wounded. I think DeGusta shot it, and the SWAT team may have gotten one or two additional rounds into it. Maybe I hit it as well. There's no way to be sure. But, Margot, being wounded makes it infinitely more dangerous. I would rather stalk 10 healthy lions than one wounded one."
He
He straightened his shoulders and felt for his gun. Lead on, please. Standing here in the dark with this bundle on my back makes me very uneasy. From now on, we use only the flashlight. Be very careful. Why don't you give me the miner's light so you'll be free to use the gun, Margo suggested. If we meet up with the beast unexpectedly, we'll have to drive it away with the light. If it's badly wounded, I doubt anything will drive it away, replied Pendergast. But here it is. They moved quietly down the corridor, around a corner, and through a service door leading into the Hall of Ancient Mammals. It seemed to Margot that her stealthy footsteps echoed like gunshots across the polished stone floor. Row upon row of glass cases gleamed dully in the glow of the flashlight. Giant elk, saber-toothed cats, dire wolves. Mastodon and woolly mammoth skeletons reared in the center of the gallery. Margot and Pendergast moved cautiously toward the hall's exit, Pendergast's gun at the ready. "See that door at the far end? The one marked staff only?" Margot whispered. "Beyond that is the corridor housing security command, staff services, and the computer lab. Around the corner is the hallway where you can set up your blind." She hesitated. "If the creature is already there..."
"I wish I'd stayed in New Orleans, Miss Green."
Stepping through the staff entrance into Section 18, they found themselves in a narrow hallway lined with doors. Pendergast swept the area with his flashlight. Nothing.
"That's it," said Margot, indicating a door to their left. "Security command."
Margot could briefly hear the murmur of voices as they passed. They passed another door marked Central Computer.
"They're sitting ducks in there," Margot said. "Should we..."
"No," came the response. "No time." They turned the corner and stopped. Pendergast played his light down the hallway.
"What's that doing there?"
he asked. Halfway down the hall, a massive steel security door flashed mockingly at them in the glow of the flashlight.
"The good doctor was mistaken," Pendergast said. "Cell 2 must cut this corridor in half. That's the edge of the perimeter there."
"What's the distance?" Margot said in a monotone. Pendergast pursed his lips.
"I'd guess 100, 125 feet at the most."
She turned to the agent. "Is that enough room?"
Pendergast remained motionless.
"No.
But it'll have to do.
Come on, Miss Green. Let's get into position."
The mobile command unit was getting stuffier. Coffee unbuttoned his shirt and loosened his tie with a savage tug. The humidity had to be 110%. He hadn't seen rain like this in 20 years. The drains were bubbling like geysers, the tires of the emergency vehicles up to their hubcaps in water. The rear door swung open, revealing a man wearing SWAT fatigues.
"Sir? What do you want?"
"The men would like to know when we're going back in."
"Going back in?" Coffee yelled. "Are you out of your mind? 6 of your men were just killed in there, torn apart like friggin' hamburger."
"But, sir, there are people still trapped in there. Maybe we could..." Coffee rounded on the man, eyes blazing, mouth spewing saliva.
"Don't you get it? We can't just go busting back in there. We sent men in not knowing what we were up against. We've got to get the power restored, get the systems back online before we..."
A policeman stuck his head inside the door of the van.
"Sir, we've just had a report of a dead body floating in the Hudson River. It was spotted down at the boat basin. Seems like it was flushed out of one of the big storm drains." "Who the fuck cares about..."
"Sir, it's a woman wearing an evening gown, and it's been tentatively identified as one of the people missing from the party."
"What?"
Coffee was confused. It wasn't possible.
"Someone from the mayor's group?"
"One of the people trapped inside. The only women still unaccounted for inside apparently went down into the basement 2 hours ago."
"You mean with the mayor?"
"I guess that would be right, sir."
Coffee felt his bladder weakening. It couldn't be true.
That fucking Pendergast, fucking the Gusta, it was all their fault. They disobeyed him, compromised his plan, sent all those people to their deaths. The mayor, dead. They were going to have his ass for that.
"Sir?"
"Get out,"
Coffee whispered.
"Both of you, get out."
The door closed.
This is Garcia, over. Does anyone copy?
The radio squawked. Coffee spun around and jabbed the radio with his finger.
Garcia, what's going on?
Nothing, sir, except the power's still out. But I have Tom Allen here. He's been asking to speak with you.
Put him on, then.
This is Allen. We're getting a little concerned in here, Mr. Coffee. There's nothing we can do until power's restored. The batteries are failing on Garcia's transmitter, and we've been keeping it off to conserve juice. We'd like you to get us out.
Coffee laughed, suddenly, shrilly. The agents manning the consoles looked uneasily at one another.
You'd like me to get you out? Listen, Allen, you geniuses created this mess. You swore up and down the system would work, that everything had a backup. So you get your own asses out. The mayor's dead, and I've already lost more men than I... Hello?
This is Garcia again. Sir, it's pitch black in here, and we only have two flashlights. What happened to the SWAT team that was being sent in?
Coffee's laughter stopped abruptly.
Garcia? They got themselves killed, you hear me? Killed. Got their guts hung up like birthday ribbons in there. And it's Pendergast's fault, and DeGusta's fault, and fucking Allen's fault, and your fault too, probably. Now, we've got men on this side working to restore the power. They say it can be done, it just may take a few hours, okay? I'm gonna take that goddamn thing in there, but in my way, in my own sweet time, so you just sit tight. I'm not gonna have more men killed to save your sorry asses.
There was a rap on the rear door.
Come in!
He barked, switching off the radio. An agent stepped inside and crouched beside Coffee, the glow of the monitors throwing his face into sharp relief.
Sir, I just got word that the deputy mayor is on his way over now, and the governor's office is on the phone. They want an update.
Coffee closed his eyes. Smithback looked up at the ladder, its rusty lower rung hanging a good 4 feet above his head. Maybe if there was no water, he could have jumped it, but with the current nearing his chest, it was impossible.
See anything up there?
DeGusta asked.
Nope. This light's weak. I can't tell how far the thing extends.
Turn off the light, then. Give me a minute to think.
There was a long silence. Smithback felt another surge against his waist. The water was still rising fast. Another foot, and they would all be floating downstream toward... Smithback shook his head, angrily dispelling the thought.
Where the hell is all this water coming from?
He moaned to no one in particular.
This sub-basement is built below the Hudson River water table. It leaks whenever there's a heavy rain.
Leaks, sure. Maybe it even floods a foot or two, but we're being inundated. They must be building arcs out there.
DeGusta didn't answer.
The hell with this.
Someone get on my shoulders. We'll go up one by one.
Stow it. It's too damn high for that.
Smithback coughed, cleared his throat.
I've got an idea,
he said. There was a silence.
Look, that steel ladder appears to be pretty strong. If we can fasten our belts together and loop them over that ladder... We can wait for the water to rise enough so we can grab the lower rung.
I can't wait that long,
someone cried. DeGusta glared.
Smithback, that's the fucking worst idea I ever heard. Besides, half the men here are wearing cummerbunds.
I noticed you have a belt on.
So I do. But what makes you think the water will rise enough for us to reach the rung?
Look up there.
Smithback said, shining his flashlight along the wall near the bottom of the metal ladder.
See that band of discoloration? It looks like a high water mark to me. At least once in the past, the water has risen that high. If this is half the storm you think it is, we ought to get fairly close.
DeGusta shook his head.
Well, I still think it's crazy, but I suppose it's better than waiting here to die. You men back there, belts, pass your belts up to me.
As the belts reached DeGusta, he knotted them together, buckle to end, starting with the widest buckle. Then he passed them to Smithback, who looped them over his shoulders. Swinging the heavier end, he braced himself against the current, leaned back, and tossed it up toward the lowest rung. The 12 feet of leather fell back into the water, missing by several feet. He tried again, missed again.
Here, give me that. Let a man do a man's job. The hell with that,
Smithback said, rearing back dangerously and giving another toss. This time, Smithback ducked as the heavy buckle came swinging down. Then he slid the far end through and pulled the improvised rope tight around the lower rung.
Okay, everyone, this is it. I want you all to link arms. Don't let go. As the water rises, it'll carry us toward the ladder. We'll play this back to you in sections as we rise. I hope this son of a bitch holds,
he muttered, eyeing the linked belts dubiously.
And the water rises far enough.
If it doesn't, you'll hear about it from me, mister.
Smithback turned to respond, but decided to save his breath. The current crept up around his chest, tugging at his armpits, and he felt a slow, inexorable pressure from below as his feet started to lose their hold on the smooth stone floor of the tunnel. 59. Garcia watched as the pool of light from Alan's flashlight moved slowly across a bank of dead controls, then back again. Nesbitt, the guard on monitoring duty, slouched at the coffee-stained panic desk in the middle of security command. Next to him sat Waters and the skinny, gawky-looking programmer from the computer lab. They had knocked on the door of security command 10 minutes earlier, scaring the three men inside half to death. Now the programmer was sitting quietly in the dark, chewing his cuticles and sniffling. Waters had placed his service revolver on the table and was nervously spinning it.
"What was that?"
Waters said suddenly, stopping his pistol in mid-spin.
"What was what?" Garcia asked morosely.
"I thought I heard a noise in the hall just now," Waters said, swallowing hard, "like feet going by."
"You're always hearing noises, Waters," Garcia said. "That's what got us here in the first place."
There was a brief, uncomfortable silence.
"Are you sure you read coffee right?" Waters spoke up again. "If that thing destroyed a SWAT team, it could easily get to us."
"Stop thinking about it," said Garcia. "Stop talking about it. It happened 3 floors above us."
"I can't believe coffee just leaving us here to rot."
"Waters, if you don't shut up, I'm going to send you back to the computer lab."
Waters fell silent.
"Radio coffee again," Alan told Garcia. "We need to get the hell out of here now."
Garcia slowly shook his head. "It ain't going to work. Sounded to me like he was about 5 beers short of a six-pack. Maybe he's bent a bit under the pressure. We're stuck here for the duration."
"Who's his boss?" Alan insisted. "Give me the radio."
"No way. The emergency batteries are almost dead."
Alan started to protest, then stopped abruptly.
"I smell something," he said.
Garcia sat up.
"So do I."
Then he picked up his shotgun, slowly, like a sleeper caught in a bad dream.
"It's the killer beast!"
Waters cried loudly. All the men were on their feet in an instant. Chairs were thrown back, smashing against the floor. There was a thump and a curse as somebody struck the side of a desk, then a splintering crash as a monitor fell to the floor. Garcia grabbed the radio.
"Coffee, it's here!"
There was a scratching, then a low rattling at the doorknob. Garcia felt a gush of warmth on his legs and realized his bladder had given way. Suddenly, the door bent inward, wood cracking under a savage blow. In the close, listening darkness, he heard somebody behind him start to pray.
"Did you hear that?"
whispered Pendergast. Margot played the flashlight down the hall.
"I heard something."
From down the hall and around the corner came the sound of splintering wood.
"It's breaking through one of the doors," said Pendergast. "We need to attract its attention."
"Hey!"
he shouted.
Margot grabbed Pendergast's arm.
"Don't say anything you wouldn't want it to understand," she hissed.
"Miss Green, this is no time for jokes," Pendergast snapped. "Surely it doesn't understand English."
"I don't know. We're taking a chance anyway, just trusting the extrapolator's data. But the thing has a highly developed brain, and it may well have been in the museum for years, listening from dark places. It might understand certain words. We can't take the chance."
"As you wish,"
Pendergast whispered. Then he said loudly,
"Where are you? Can you hear me?"
"Yes," Margot shouted. "But I'm lost. Help! Can anyone hear us?"
Pendergast lowered his voice.
It must have heard that. Now we can only wait.
He dropped to one knee, right hand aiming the .45, left hand bracing right wrist.
Keep playing the light toward the bend in the hallway. Move it around as if you're lost. When I see the creature, I'll give you the word. Turn on the miner's light, and keep it aimed on the creature no matter what. If it's angry, if it's just hunting for revenge now, we have to use any means possible to slow it down. We only have 100 feet of corridor in which to kill it. If it can run as quickly as you think it can, the beast can cover that distance in a couple of seconds. You can't hesitate, and you can't panic.
A couple of seconds, Margot said. I understand.
Garcia kneeled in front of the monitor bank, the butt of his shotgun snug against his cheek, the barrel pointing into the gloom. Before him, the outline of the door was faintly visible. Behind him stood Waters in a combat stance.
When it comes through, just start firing and don't stop, Garcia said. I've only got 8 rounds. I'll try to space my shots so you can reload at least once before it reaches us. And turn off that flashlight. You're trying to give us away?
The others in security command, Alan, the programmer, and Nesbitt, the guard, had retreated to the far wall and were crouched beneath the darkened schematic of the museum's security grid. Waters was shaking.
It blew away a SWAT team, he said, his voice breaking.
There was another crash, and the door groaned, its hinges popping. Waters screamed, jumped up, and scrambled back into the dark, his gun lying forgotten on the floor.
Waters, you prick, get back here!
Garcia heard the sickening thud of bone against metal as Waters stumbled under the desks toward the far wall, banging his skull.
Don't let it get me!
He screamed. Garcia forced himself to turn back toward the door. He tried to steady the shotgun. The foul reek of the creature filled his nostrils as the door shuddered under another heavy blow. More than anything, he did not want to see what was about to force its way into the room. He cursed and wiped his forehead with the back of a hand. Except for Waters sobbing, there was silence.
Margot shined the flashlight down the hall, trying to imitate the random motions of somebody searching for a way out. The light licked across the walls and floor, giving dim illumination to the display cabinets. Her heart was hammering, her breath coming in short gasps.
Help! She cried again. We're lost!
Her voice sounded unnaturally hoarse in her ears. There were no more sounds from around the corner. The creature was listening.
Hello?
She called, willing herself to speak again.
Is anybody there?
The voice echoed and died in the corridor. She waited, staring into the gloom, straining to see any movement. A dark shape began to resolve itself against the far darkness, at a distance where the flashlight beam failed. The movement stopped. It seemed to have its head up. A strange, liquid snuffling sound came toward them.
Not yet, Pendergast whispered.
It moved a little farther around the corner. The snuffling noise grew louder. And then the stench, wafting down the hall, violated her nostrils. The beast took another step.
Not yet,
Pendergast whispered. Garcia's hand was shaking so violently he could hardly press the transmit button.
Coffee, he hissed. Coffee, for God's sake, do you copy?
This is Agent Slade from the forward command post. Who's speaking, please?
This is Security Command. Garcia said, breathing thick and fast. Where's Coffee? Where's Coffee?
Special Agent Coffee is temporarily indisposed. As of now, I'm taking command of the operation, pending the arrival of the regional director. What's your status?
What's our status?
Garcia laughed raggedly.
Our status is we're fucked! It's outside the door. It's breaking in. I'm begging you, send a team in.
Hell! Why wasn't I informed?
Garcia heard some muffled talk.
Garcia, do you have your weapon?
What good's a shotgun?
Garcia whispered, almost in tears.
You need to get in here with a fucking bazooka. Help us, please.
Garcia, we're trying to pick up the pieces here. Command and control is all screwed up. Just hold tight a moment. It can't get through the security command door, right? It's metal, isn't it?
It's wood, Slade. It's just a goddamn institutional door, Garcia said, the tears running freely down his face.
Wood? What kind of place is this? Garcia, listen to me now. Even if we sent someone in, it'd take them 20 minutes to get to you.
Please!
You've got to handle it yourself. I don't know what you're up against, Garcia, but get a grip on yourself. We'll be in as soon as we can. Just keep cool and aim.